Welcome to On Dunmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Join us each week to hear the stories that impact the land and communities of our peninsula. If you tuned in last week, you heard our interview with Ted Wykall, James Atkins, and Jake Day, all of whom grew up in agricultural families on Maryland's eastern shore, and are still actively involved working to ensure that farming has a bright future on Dunmarva. First in the show today, we'll hear the continuation of that conversation. Then we'll hear from Governor Martin O'Malley, Speaker of the House Michael Bush, and Senate President Mike Miller from our Annapolis summit on the opening day of the legislative session in Maryland. Finally, don't miss our correspondent Tom Horton's account of a day on the Chesapeake with softshell crabber David Laird. First, let's check in on the traffic, and then we'll be right back with Ted Wykall, James Atkins, and Jake Day. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are joined by Ted Wykall, an organic farmer who runs Green Branch Farm in Salisbury, Maryland, James Atkins, who's a member of the Wicomico Young Farmers and agriculture engineer as well, Jake Day, town planning director for the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy, and grew up in a family of Purdue men and women, I guess. And I'm Mark
Steiner. Just one.
I'm Mark Steiner. You're listening to On Dunmarva. So, you know, before we jumped into this conversation, Ted, you were talking about going on the web and looking at oil and the reserves.
It's something that I follow. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of forecasts out there, but one of the most striking recent forecasts is one that the International Energy Agency put out just recently, I think within the last 6 months. And it was it's a chart that I was looking at, and the chart showed that conventional crude oil peaked in 2006. And so that could have profound implications, because, crude oil is the easiest to refine, the cheapest to refine. It's basically what, you know, industrial society has been built upon. And once you get out of that, then you're looking at like coal sands and ethanol and other sorts of energy sources.
And Amazon and mountains and the Gulf and deep water.
Yeah, deep sea drilling.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So it was something that that has profound implications for our society, if that is indeed accurate. And even if it's not, most people would agree that the peak is going to come within – this is 2011 now, within the next 15 years. So, you know, that's still not a long time.
And you were saying, I think after you said that, Jake, that when you worked as an intern, whatever it was, at IEA for a while, that you saw this even before that.
Well, this is – I spent 2 weeks there.
Two weeks.
I didn't work for them, but it was just as a part of my graduate studies in environmental policy at Oxford. We moved to Paris to the IEA headquarters and stayed there for 2 weeks and learned from them. And at the time, I don't think this report was published at all. But
it's fairly recent.
But the researchers were saying the same thing and were saying that it was something that they had known for a while and were a message they were trying to get out and I guess articulate in a report of some kind. But at that time, they were saying, look, we've known this. It's going to affect us dramatically in the next 20 years, and we should have taken action 20 years ago, not today. It's almost too – it's not too late, but it's late. We are late in the game.
The Hirsch Report is also another study that came out by –
What's it called?
It's called the Hirsch Report. Came out in the – it's a United States government study, and that speaks to the implications of peak oil and, you know, the amount of time it takes to prepare for that.
How do you think – and James, your listeners, what do you think – how do you think this affects farming?
Well, as Ted mentioned earlier during the break, he was talking that, you know, an oil-conscious agriculture is going to require a dramatic shift in how things are done, getting away from, you know, tractors and combines and big equipment to more hand labor and animal power and that type of stuff. And I jokingly said something about you're envisioning the United States being Amish agriculture for the entire country, and you basically said yes.
I mean, sort of. I don't know a lot about the Amish agriculture system, but certainly what we've been doing can't continue. We can't grow a cow in Montana, ship it to Iowa, and then ship corn from Iowa and all surrounding states in, feed the cow, and then ship it to a processing plant another, 400 miles away, cut it up, and then distribute it 1,000 miles across the country to grocery stores. That's just – that system I don't think is – it doesn't have a lot of potential in a energy-scarce environment.
Well, jumping off from what Ted just said, to James and then to Jake, then let's just take his argument for a minute about where that takes us.
If that's the case, the world as we know it has got to dramatically change. It's 1790, 90% of the United States population was directly involved in an agricultural employment or a job of some sort. By 1900, that had dropped to 41%, and now it's roughly 2%. So, that change from 1790 to 1900 it freed up the labor that enabled the Industrial Revolution to be possible. So all these other careers and industries that revolve kind of separate from agriculture are going to have to be dramatically shifted to shift that workforce back to ag if we're going to look at a non-petroleum-based agriculture.
Non-petroleum. We're looking at scarcity of petroleum. So petroleum will still be available.
Okay. Limited petroleum.
Right.
More expensive petroleum.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So my question to James during the break, and we didn't get an opportunity to talk about it, but my question is let me give you an example of another industry other than agriculture. The steel industry in Pittsburgh produced the majority of the world's steel prior to 1950, let's say. In the early part of the 20th century, they were producing the majority of the world's steel. That plummeted over the 60s, 70s, 80s, and a report by Dr. Jerry Paytas from Carnegie Mellon articulates this, that, steel production plummeted, steel jobs plummeted, Pittsburgh plummeted. Pittsburgh lost two-thirds of its population over that time. That said, today, steel production has increased, and now Pittsburgh produces more steel than it did prior to the 1940s, with 10% of the jobs. So it hasn't regained the jobs, but it's producing more steel, and it's doing that through efficiency. So my question was, and this is notwithstanding the fact that the United States population has grown significantly, and so that 90% of what was the population in 1790 is maybe, close to what 2% of the population is today. I don't know.
I don't know
what the population was
in 1790. 1790.
I don't either. I'm impressed that 90% of the population was in farming.
70.
But what I'm wondering is, have efficiencies been experienced? And if we were to, say, increase from 2 to 5% of the American population employed in farming, would we increase production of food that much that it would be?
I have no idea.
Okay.
The question I ask is, are the American people or any people willing to make the shift from what they know to what it's going to require to make that happen?
Yeah.
Who knows whether it's 5%, 10%? That's a guess until you get into that boat and realize what the efficiencies will be with modern techniques. Nobody will never know.
But you were saying, and this is before we kind of get into the question of the future and where agriculture might go. One of the things you were saying also during this conversation off mic, Ted Wirecall, was that you have a real problem with organic farms that are these gigantic farms and these monocrop farms.
Yeah, just because a farm's organic doesn't make it, in my book, a sustainable farm, doesn't make it better from certain standpoints. There are farms out there that are 1,000 acres of lettuce, grown on plastic mulch, sprayed with organic insecticides every day, and then it's shipped all over the entire country, and that I think that defeats the intention and the spirit of what organic was at when it was founded, what the government had in mind when the organic label was created. I think that is not it. So even within organic farms, there's definitely a wide array of types of farms. So just because something has that organic label, don't think that it comes from some kind of an Eden-like place.
So there seems to be a whole almost disconnect between the notion that organic agriculture has value because supposedly the product is healthier for the consumer, to this whole environmentally conscious type production that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that it doesn't have harmful chemicals sprayed on it. That's good. I don't want to discount that fact. However, I seriously doubt that they're taking really good care of their soil. I just don't see how it could even happen on that kind of a scale. my main point being that we have to go beyond just looking at superficial labels. Just one term, labeling something organic, is not therefore going to make all organic equal.
No, but it's,
go ahead, Jay.
No, but it's admirable, and there are advantages. Obviously, you've articulated them here. But I think in addition to scale, let's not forget the earlier point, location and transport efficiency. I think what both of you do contributes to location and transport efficiency, which is not just good for the environment, but it's good for the economy. And I think when you think about the Delmarva Peninsula as a distinct and well-defined region, the more we can achieve those sorts of efficiencies, the better off our economy is going to be locally and the better off we're going to be on the shore.
One of the things that we were talking about off mic is that I asked the question whether when you asked him about it, do you want everybody to become Amish farmers, Amish-style farming, could that feed America? Could we feed our country in the way, if that would happen? I mean, right now, most of the food we get comes from large-scale production or smaller farmers who are tied to larger companies who grow for them, whether it's beef or corn or whatever it is, or poultry.
My argument would be maybe we can feed the United States, but the current system feeds much more than the United States population. There's a lot of exports of soy meal and then corn to China and India and all parts of the world. So there may have, if you say strictly starting in 2020, we're going to go to a pseudo Amish agriculture system, a petroleum limited system. Somebody's going to have to make a decision of what part of the population of the world is going to starve.
I think that we're just going to have to need more farmers. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that, we do pastured poultry, okay? And it was our first year doing it, and we were doing about 200 birds a week for a little over 6 months. And so I'm not reaching the efficiencies of CAFO industrial.
Right. You're talking about 30,000 chickens or 40,000 chickens per farm or more, right?
Per house.
Per house.
30,000 per
house. 30,000 per house on a given farm.
In 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm. In 8 weeks.
Or less.
Right. Or less. Right. So.
Well, here, my point. My point.
Scary being. Chicken. But so, and so you're 200 a week.
But that's a lot of protein that feeds a lot of mouths across the country and the world.
Sure. But right. my point is that, we have to look at how many, 2% of the, let's just say 2% of the population is farmers. Okay. If people are going to farm, if my farm was the average farm out there, if, that model was, used all over the country, and everybody was growing, 10, 15 acres of vegetables plus cattle plus pigs plus chickens, how many people could one pastured poultry operation feed with poultry? And if I'm growing 200 a week, okay, I'm only going to eat a half of a chicken a week. So my wife and I will share one chicken a week. So if we just say one chicken a week per two people, we're growing 400 people's worth of chicken a week. You know what I mean? So we need one person per 400 growing pastured poultry. That's a quarter of 1%.
What are you thinking?
I mean, now that doesn't include the feed. I mean, somebody else has got to grow the feed, you know, the grains and all that, of course. But, I mean, just as far as poultry rearing itself, a quarter of 1%. And granted, that is for 6 months. So, I mean, on pasture, then we can pull them into buildings, do other things. But, I mean, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good turnout.
I tend to look at that comment in a historical perspective. Take us back to the early 20th century, where cars were handmade. Only the most wealthy could afford those.
Like a Tesla cost $150,000.
Or a Lamborghini. It's handmade now. You know, nobody's really going to afford it, your average man. When Henry Ford refined the you know, interchangeable parts and the assembly line and that type of stuff, it brought that price down where the average Joe could afford a car. We're looking at almost the same system in food. When it's hand-produced, it's very expensive. The systems that aren't industrialized, I guess it's the term that everybody wants to use today, in other countries, you just said earlier how they spend a disproportionately higher amount of their income on their food. We have very cheap food because of those efficiencies realized by that agricultural system we have in place. So, you know, we've got to remember there's folks in this world that are living on a couple dollars a day, and we're providing a lot of the protein and the food that they're taking in. So even a small increase in price that's realized by, you know, changing our methods may be the difference between starvation and nourishment for some of those folks. You know, I question whether we can actually change the fundamental integration of agriculture and still have the same value or price to our food.
I would certainly concede that you know, our chicken costs more. That's, you know, we can't produce it for the same price that Tyson or Purdue can do. But getting back to the energy part of the equation here is that entire system is built upon a foundation of petroleum and cheap petroleum. So the prices of that food, the energy inputs that go into producing that, are immense. I mean, the birds are grown in a chicken house, which is extremely energy intense to build. A lot of concrete, a lot of materials. You know, it's fed with you know, a lot of electricity, heated by propane. Chickens are transported all over the place. The feed that goes into feeding those chickens is the field is going to be tilled with a petroleum powered tractor. It's going to be planted with a petroleum powered tractor. It's going to be sprayed with herbicides and pesticides that are based in petroleum. It's going to be harvested by a tractor, and then transported once again. So we're looking at extremely high petroleum input. Okay, so that food is only as cheap as the energy that produces it, and what happens if that energy increases in price? Maybe at some point in time, I would argue that once petroleum hits a certain dollar amount, that doing things by hand might equal out and then even be cheaper.
This is why I stand by my earlier comment that while the market may increase for large commercial agriculture producers, I think the market share is going to continue to increase for local farmers selling their product to the localities where they exist. And I think it has to do with what will be – I mean, it's based in the fact that energy and transport is going to become more expensive, and it's going to be a resurgence in the basic model of rural economic geography, that the town is the place where we have – commerce and the exchange of goods and services based on what people need who live in the town and in the hinterland. And in that hinterland, we're going to produce the food around that town that is consumed within the towns and the cities. And I think that will grow slowly, but I think it will grow.
That's a model that's worked for a long time. It's been, you know, fairly recently as far as history goes that we have been on the food system that we have now.
But not the model also that you were just talking about, James, which is the model that feeds not just America, but feeds the world.
That's right.
And a lot of farmers make their living on the foods exported outside the country, not just on inside the country. So that, I mean, that's...
Well, they're also feeding an industrializing part of the world. That part of the world is growing and probably displacing a lot of American agricultural products as it grows.
Well, there's a, and I wonder how much we can get this. We don't have enough time to get into the agricultural bill and all the things that are inside of that, which we'll be doing over the course of this year, because I think it's part of what defines where agriculture is going to go. But an interesting stat that I got this morning, I don't know how this makes a difference in this discussion or not, but that 81% of the beef, 73% of our sheep, 56% of our pigs, and half of our poultry come from four companies. Four companies. And that of all that, though, only 33% of the farmers in America who are tied to that get subsidies. The rest don't. How does that affect the way we grow our food? How does that affect our agriculture? How would it? Because my guess is you don't get a subsidy.
I didn't want to get into subsidies, but no, I don't.
And my guess is on your little farm, you don't get subsidies, right?
Not on the vegetable production.
Right, right, right.
That's politics run amok. I mean, that doesn't gel with anyone thinking about what you just said, Mark. I mean, that doesn't make sense. You know, if those subsidies are applied to a large-scale producer, they should absolutely equally be applied to a small-scale producer. I can't think of a good argument against that. That doesn't make sense. And that sounds to me like politics run amok, that someone was able to convince Congress to pass a law that excluded small farmers from those subsidies, and that no one's called them on it.
I don't think the current laws exclude small farmers. There's no if you don't meet a certain acreage requirement, it's typically based on cropping method and the crop grown, that small farmers tend to go to the ones that aren't subsidized. They have other programs that will assure income. They're more support programs to prevent, you know, complete disaster. Ted can be enrolled in some of these adjusted gross revenue programs where he says, I make X per year, and they will guarantee that if he has a complete drought and loses everything, that he at least gets 80% of what his average income is. And that's there for any type of crop. But like you said, there's definitely a disparity between who's getting them and who's not.
And it's not logical.
I think that's something that the reason I raise it really on this program, and we'll keep raising it and talking about what it means, is because, I mean, I'm not a farmer, but I'm concerned about agriculture and our food and where we're going, you know, just as a society. And that fact that you two guys are young and farmers and want to stay that way, right?
And want to raise a family that way.
And you want to raise a family that way. And if your children want to take over, you want them to be able to take over.
By all means.
Right.
So the question is, how do we get Delmarva to be that place where you don't have to, where your children don't have to worry about being farmers if they want to?
I think the biggest concern I have is whether my children want to be a farmer. I mean,
why did you want to be a farmer then? I mean, your father was a farmer, right?
No, my father was a full-time teacher, part-time farmer.
Okay, part-time.
Raised vegetables on the side. My uncle's a full-time farmer. My grandfather was, and God only knows how many generations back it was.
But farming. You went to study it. You studied agriculture in college?
Agricultural engineering, and I love it. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy getting up and sweating a little. I enjoy going out and, well, I can't say that I enjoy not knowing if I'm going to make any money this year. But I do enjoy, you know, working with the crops, working with the land, and dealing with the people that I sell my product to. So I don't think you'll hear anybody say, I got into farming for the money. It's in your blood. You got to love it to do it.
I totally agree with that. I couldn't imagine doing something else now. I mean, I've been doing it for 5 years, and that's all I see in the future.
And your world, Jake, is about making that world survive, right?
Without a doubt. You know, I get up in the morning. I sweat too, but for a different reason. I wish I could work outside, and I think that's
you just have to work and work out because then you have to go on your weekends before they
that's
get
right.
Your haircut.
That's
you go to the
exactly
reserves.
Right.
You have to sweat that way.
That's exactly right. I don't have a choice either. But I mean, what we do absolutely is to ensure that farmers get to keep farming on the Delmarva Peninsula, and that's important to us, not only because that's the source of our food, but because it's something that we respect as part of our culture on the shore. And as James said, it's and as Ted indicated, it's in their blood. That's just part of who we are here on the Eastern Shore. And although I don't farm, you know, my dad worked on farms, my brother works on farms, and I know he would love to be able to farm one day. I'm sure he's told James that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the despite the diminishing number of farmers, I mean, the culture of farming in some ways still dominates Delmarva.
Oh, yeah.
Without a doubt.
For sure.
I think the population here is more connected to agriculture than there are, with the exception of maybe the Midwest, but for other regions, maybe the population is a little more divorced from the farm, and so much of our economy revolves around ag industries, and it's such an important part of the whole notion of what is our economy. I think everybody has to have a relationship with ag.
I was sitting here as we were talking about this conversation and raising these issues. I know that, I mean, big poultry is a power on the in Delmarva. I mean, that's just the reality. Just and there's a lot that's going on right now that's kind of questioning that, the lawsuit that's taking place from the environmentalists that involves Purdue and involves the Hudson farmers, family farm. And I'm just curious, what are your thoughts about that? I don't know, because maybe you can't get into it because you have with your job, but you two are independent. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's really unfortunate that they've got so much on the line now with a lawsuit. They're facing a lawsuit and having to pay those kinds of legal bills.
You mean about the Hudsons?
That's right, yeah. And, I would hope that... I would hope that there was other ways to resolve this issue. So I just, I got a lot of sympathy for them. That's all, I'm not saying I don't know the details of the situation. But just from one farmer to another, I just, I can sympathize with them.
I firmly believe that if you want to change a current habit or a practice, you don't use a stick. And if I want you to stop smoking, I want to, convey to you the health effects of that, the expense of that, and try and encourage you to quit on your own rather than beat you with a bat until you quit. And I kind of draw a parallel with the notion that a lawsuit is a bat, and it doesn't always get the reaction that you're looking for. People tend to lock their heels and resist anything moving in any direction other than the status quo. So from an educational standpoint, I think there's an opportunity if there's something that needs to be changed or a practice that needs to be changed. And I don't know that litigation and regulation is always the solution.
I have nothing prohibiting me from commenting this. I'm not in any way involved with that lawsuit, nor is the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy involved in any lawsuit. I would say that James is right on that you need carrots as much, if not more, than you need sticks. I think there's a time and a place for tough regulation, but knowing nothing really about this lawsuit other than what I've read in the papers, I can't comment substantively on it other than to say I thought it was confirmed that it was biosolids on this particular property, not poultry litter. Okay. So with that said...
I think the biggest part of that lawsuit, I think, has to do for a lot of people. I think in some ways maybe the whole Hudson issue obfuscates it, which is the main part of that lawsuit was supposed to be, does Purdue, Tyson, or any other large company mm-hmm. that contracts with farmers have as much responsibility or more than the farmer themselves in terms of what happens? I think that's getting lost in the whole question whether or not the Hudson should have been sued or not.
Well, and I think the other question that it brings up for me is how are we managing human settlement, human development on the shore as much as we ask the question about agricultural practices? So we need to ask question in this case, about how we're managing our own waste and our own development, our own communities, as much as we're asking the question about agriculture.
Gentlemen, this has been great. I appreciate you taking all this time with On Delmarva.
It was fun.
Thank you so much.
James Atkins, Ted Wycall, Jake Day, thank you so much. I'm Mark Steiner for On Delmarva. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to On Delmarva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and we'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.
Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. The new legislative session just began in Annapolis. And this year, there will be many issues that will affect Delmarva, from offshore wind to fracking to tax policy and more. Up next, join us for selections from our Annapolis Summit with Governor Martin O'Malley, Speaker of the House Michael Bush, and Senate President Mike Miller. We'll hear a number of audience questions for our leaders. But up first, here's Don Rush from Public Radio Delmarva, and he posed these questions.
Hey, this is Don Rush from Public Radio Delmarva. And the question I had, actually, I was struck by the vehemence, I guess, about the idea that perhaps we shouldn't provide money to clean up the bay because we're asking, for instance, for state workers to be furloughed. Right. So I'm curious about how much we expect then that money to clean up the bay will be cut. Is that where you favor cutting it? How do you see this fitting into the EPA, which has set out its own guidelines to require states to clean up the bay? How does that fit into your budget plans? And as you probably know, the Farm Bureau Federation, the American Farm Bureau Federation, has said it's going to file suit to oppose that. Do you think that then the cleanup of the bay should be, say, left to the states rather than the feds? Where are you on this? And are you vigorously opposed, say, to expending more money on the cleaning of the bay?
No, the bay is the crown jewel of the state of Maryland. It's the largest estuary in the United States. I live on the Chesapeake Bay. You know, I wanted my legacy in politics to be two things, education and the bay. 3 years now, we're number one in education through Thornton for me. I want to continue that to be. I'm the oldest of 10 kids, went to a public school. I've lived in southern Maryland my entire life, between the Potomac River, the Patuxent River, and the Chesapeake Bay. We need to preserve and protect our environment. And we're not going to back off from the Chesapeake Bay. We're going to continue to do the Chesapeake Bay. We've got these tough stormwater, storm drain regulations in place. And we're protecting the bay from nitrogen, from phosphorus, from sediment. You know, my area is a large farming area. You know, the chicken farmers are objecting, the livestock farmers are objecting, but somehow we're going to have to bring the farmers to the table. They're not the main polluters of the bay, but the sewer people, the people involved in the sewage that goes in the bay, they've got to be brought to heel. The builders of houses that build homes for Harry and Harriet homeowners that put the fertilizer on the lawns that go through the storm drains and the creeks and rivers, they've got to be brought to heel. And basically, the farmers as well. So it takes a little bit of everything. I support the EPA and the regulations. We're going to work to make those regulations work and preserve and protect the Chesapeake Bay. And we're going to continue to provide funding resources. But at the same time, these tough fiscal times, just like you don't want to knock people off the Medicaid rolls, you don't want to cut education. At the same time, we can't afford to do what we've been doing in terms of the Chesapeake Bay.
Let me just make a statement. I'm happy that the EPA has stepped in, but I hope the EPA is as stringent in the regulations with our neighboring states of Pennsylvania and Virginia, who put very little resources into protecting the bay compared to the state of Maryland. I mean, Maryland continues to make an investment in the bay, and I would say we are the chief stewards of it. But you cannot continue to put the type of money that we put into it and then have a storm come down the Susquehanna and bring all the waste from Pennsylvania here without some kind of oversight from the EPA. But it's also another example where the federal government comes in, puts regulatory oversight in, and does not identify a funding source to make it happen. So, I mean, while we've been very vigilant and have invested in the bay, It takes a regional approach to the Chesapeake Bay. And if the EPA is going to come in and mandate the type of regulations they want to mandate, I think they have an obligation to make sure that our neighboring states follow the same mandates the state of Maryland follows.
This is a quick follow-up, because my understanding is the EPA decided to step in because the states were not doing this. They were not coordinating enough in order to cut back. And is there enough money to meet the EPA demands?
Well, I think the reason the EPA is involved because, you know, the bay starts up with the Susquehanna in New York. I mean, that's the filtering into the bay. The reason is New York is not doing what it's doing, Pennsylvania is not doing what it's doing, Virginia is not doing what it's doing. It takes all involved. You know, we brought the canvas back, ducks back, we brought the rockfish back, we brought the crab back, now we've got to bring the oysters back. But it involves all the states working together with the federal government. And thus far, we haven't had a unifying force. But now we've got the federal government to look at, including with penalties. If we don't agree to these total maximum loads, I think we're going to finally see moving up from the D minuses maybe to the C minuses, maybe even a B plus and a B minus in my lifetime in terms of preserving and protecting the Chesapeake Bay.
Good morning. Allison Prose, Chesapeake Bay Foundation. I wanted to follow up on the first question related to the environment and the budget. I want to know, do you see, in the absence of additional new funding, are there ways, though, that we can do funding for the environment and the local jobs that they often create? Do you all see any possibilities with that respect?
We have to think out of the box. For example, one of the bills that we sponsored last year was the creation of a Chesapeake Conservation Corps, which is sort of like the CCC in the Depression. We've got young people being hired, being assigned to all of the various environmental agencies, working to bring back and restore the rivers, the bays, and what have you. So that's just one innovative idea that we've have adopted, and hopefully we can think of a dozen others with your help.
Yeah, look, I think that we've made every opportunity and every effort to protect the bay and our environmental priorities. Even in the toughest of times, we've continued to fully fund program Open Space. Many people that, like yourself, that protect the bay believe you protect the land, you protect the bay and the tributaries. There'll be a question whether we will increase the fee for the upgrade of water treatment plants and storage plants as we go through this to limit runoff into the tributaries in the bay. The Chesapeake Conservation Corps has been a great idea to initiate it in the Senate. I think that's a benefit. I think the fact that we've invested $20 million in the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay for the last 2 years in the toughest economic times speaks to the commitment that the Governor O'Malley and the General Assembly have had to the Bay.
My one quick follow-up to that is, as we see the budget process continue, and if there are cuts to environmental programs, what is the political will for some maybe tougher environmental policies to demonstrate the priority that Maryland has for the Bay and the environment?
You're going to see tougher environmental policies when these regulations come out from EPA in terms of preserving the Chesapeake Bay. You're going to hear people squealing. In fact, the American Farmers Association is filing suit.
They filed
right
on Monday.
Now, filing suit to block these regulations. So it's going to be litigious. We're going to work through it, but we're going to preserve and protect and restore the Chesapeake Bay.
And following up with that, I mean, though, we keep talking about farmers, and farming has a huge amount to do with the phosphorus and nitrogen goes into our water.
Right.
However, perhaps the largest polluters of our bay are the vehicles we drive, runoff from our cars, are the chemicals we put on our lawns,
right,
what goes into the sewage plants. In fact, it's going to cost $10 to $20 billion to refurbish. Right. The water treatment in the state of Maryland. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, farmers have to do their share, but we keep always talking about farmers. We're not talking about the way we live our lives, period, has to change.
Well, the state of Maryland is second to none in terms of clean air and clean water. Honestly, any idea that's in it, we get complaints because we're too close to California in terms of adopting environmental cars, greenhouses, preserving set-offs of the Chesapeake Bay and critical areas, tough environmental restrictions. I mean, we are working very hard, diligently as a state, to move forward in terms of our rules and regulations to preserve the Chesapeake Bay.
I mean, all these are tough challenges. I mean, you have 5.5 million people here. I mean, if you asked 3 million to leave and you only had 2 million people here, it'd be a lot easier on the bay. So, we'll ask for volunteers to clean up the bay by volunteering to leave the state. What do you think, Mark? Huh? Can you start that effort?
Sure, I'll
want to come here because you've got a vibrant workplace, you've got a great education system, you're around the Chesapeake Bay, and you got to balance the overall welfare of all that with the people who want to reside in the state of Maryland. And the legislature is it can't be a catch-all for everything. I mean, there does have to come a point of individual responsibility and people standing up and saying, you know, we believe in these services, we want to do this, and come to Annapolis and make it happen. They just can't sit back and say, no.
Hi, my name is Megan Cronin, and I'm with Environment Maryland. And first, Governor O'Malley, I wanted to thank you so much for introducing such a strong watershed implementation plan for the Bay. And my question is about the future of fertilizer policy in Maryland. It's come to my attention that runoff from lawn fertilizer is a huge source of pollution to the Chesapeake Bay, and it's one that needs to be urgently addressed and reduced. And a fifth of Maryland's land cover is home lawns, and that proportion is growing with every year that we develop. And in these hard economic times and with TMDL goals that need to be met, fertilizer reduction plans make sense. They're cheap, they're effective, and there are lots of graphs that show this. New Jersey is just one of the many states that have introduced this legislation. They did it very recently, and I would like to know if you think that Maryland could be the next state to step up to the plate.
They not only introduced it, they passed it, right?
Well, right, they passed it. Yeah, they signed it last week.
Boy, do I hate it, particularly when New Jersey beats us to something. Were you at the transition that we had on the Eastern Shore on the environment? We had about 700 people that came together for a whole day. We've been doing transitions instead of focusing department by department, where every transition committee concludes their work by saying, this department, unlike all the others, needs more money. We've instead focused on the big goals, like a more sustainable, cleaner, greener Maryland. Another one was on skills of our people. Another one was on job creation in the new economy. Did a health one health the other day, and then security and public safety is tomorrow. But that issue came up. And I think there is a bill that is being proposed in the General Assembly by someone, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
I've heard rumor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we need to look at it, and these are the things that we need to do together, take the actions that we need to take, because that watershed improvement plan, as hard as it might have been to write, it's even harder to do. It's going to take a lot of action, and a lot of us haven't. We need to become much more, I don't know what the word is, engaged. I need to do a better job of getting counties on board or getting communities on board at the county, at the neighborhood level, at the watershed level. We have some great websites, by the way, for anybody listening along here. Baystat, we have Stream Health that's online. Our state makes better use of GIS, Geographic Information Systems, and mapping than any other state does when it comes to environmental remediation. And I'm looking forward to that conversation about changes in something as ubiquitous as Scrabble word, ubiquitous, as as the fertilizer on our lawns. We touched off one. There was, I think it was Brian Frost, Senator Frost, that had the bill on banning phosphorus from dishwashing detergent. At the time, the captains of industry said, this is horrible, you know, bad things will fall from the sky, dogs and cats will live together, you can't do this. And then lo and behold, just 5 years later, I think the entire industry changed. Every state started doing it. And you've seen the waters of the Chesapeake Bay, while still having a long way to go, are cleaner than they've been in the last 6 years. So perhaps this lawn fertilizer idea is something like that, that everybody can take part in and be proud of.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll get you on the air to push that. Go ahead, next.
Carly Mercer with Maryland Public Interest Research Group, and my question is about energy efficiency, specifically Empower Maryland goals. While it appears that Maryland is on track to reach the Empower Maryland goals, the utilities are very far behind where they need to be, and also a lot of the decrease in energy use is due to the economic downturn. What is your plan to really get the utilities on track to meet these goals so that we can make some real energy savings when the economy does rebound?
Thank you. Great question. Among the 15 big strategic goals, Mark, is our goal of reducing energy consumption by 15% by 2015, which was the Empower Maryland goal. We could have a robust conversation about the degree to which the overattainment of that energy conservation is attributable to the recession and how much of it is attributable to the actions that we've taken. I think it's probably a combination of the two. One of the things where we're demonstrably way ahead of the curve is on peak reduction. What's the term of art? Peak reduction demand. I'm the one generalist in the family. I have to take a refresher every now. Peak reduction demand, which in essence you sign up with the utility company, then they can control your thermostat in those peak times when the hottest days they pull down your air conditioning when nobody's in the house anyway. So that's one thing that we've done. The change in terms of, you know, the weatherization is part of this. The Recovery and Reinvestment Act dollars funded, and the industry that's growing up around that, the clean energy, the clean jobs, green jobs goal is a part of this. The bill that we're going to be introducing, I'm not supposed to talk about legislative stuff today, am I? The bill that we're going to be introducing that gives credit to solar hot water heaters is part of that. When we introduce it, don't tell anyone.
Keep it on down low.
So all of those things are things that we do together. We do map this. By the way, if anybody wants to see graphs that are moving in both the wrong direction and the right direction and flatlined, the place on the state government website to find this is under the delivery unit, where we have each of those 15 goals and the graphs that support them. So those are some of the things that we'll do together. And if you have other ideas, by golly, now's the time.
Great. Thank you for making it a priority.
Thank you.
In a larger question here, in the last 7 or 8 minutes we have, so we'll get to the question next, is on the energy issue. I mean, the reality is that just kind of refitting our storm drains and reducing runoff that way could cost $10 to $20 billion. I mean, where does the money come from to really, and then people are talking about cutting back on the program that preserves land in Maryland, because cuts come out from someplace. Many people are guessing that's one place those cuts are going to come from, is that program. And that you look at that and the combination of that, and people are saying that, you know, the how we're going to get our energy in the future, where's it going to come from? You're pushing wind power. Other people are also saying we're going to do fracking. Going after the gas, which has caused people's water to be destroyed across America. Go to Wyoming, where I visit, and you turn on the tap, and because of fracking, the water's on fire. I mean, so we're facing real issues about our energy future. So in terms of cost and what you think you can get done in the next 4 years, give us a reality check and assessment.
Sure. All of those things are connected. There's a certain unity to all of those things. You ask, Mark, where the money comes from for this. The money comes from us. The money comes from all of us. Where does the money come from for permanent tax cuts for the wealthiest 1% of Americans? That comes from us. Where does the money come from, even in credit card financed, never-ending desert wars? Where does that come from? It comes from us. Who bears the cost of exploiting minerals and permanently damaging and diminishing our natural resources of our streams and our woods and our bays and our river? That cost is carried by us. The cost of not taking action on renewable energy is, where does the cost of that get absorbed? It gets absorbed by us. What we have lost sight of is the inclusive nature of that word, U.S. It includes the next generation. And sadly, what we're doing and what we're not doing it and how we're doing and not doing it is a cost that we are placing on the next generation and the one after that. If we don't do something as a species on global warming, half of the lower shore is going to be underwater in the future. So the costs are all our costs. The freedom to do something about it, though, is ours. And probably the greatest freedom is the freedom to be responsible in our own time, to keep faith with the past, but to do right by the next generation. And so, you know, in our state, in the state capital, in this session, in our nation, we need to find ways to recognize, to realize, to respect the unity that is, and find ways to work together that's consistent with that unity. And that's the great human challenge.
You've been listening to selections from the 2011 Annapolis Summit. Up next, On Delmarva correspondent Tom Horton recounts a day on the Chesapeake with softshell crabber David Laird.
It's 2:30 a.m. when David Laird downs a cup of coffee and walks to his wooden crab shanty perched on harbor's edge. He'll spend the next hour fishing up, moving with a small dip net along rows of shallow wooden tanks lit by bare light bulbs overhead. Pumps draw water from the bay beneath his shanty constantly through the tanks. Crabs that have shed overnight, Laird must remove and pack lest they begin rebuilding their shells from the minerals in the bay water. It's a fine line. Fish up a crab that is a little too soft and it won't survive to market. Leave it in the tank a little too long and it'll turn buckram, shell stiff as cardboard and unsellable. The fishing up and catching of soft shells occupies David and his wife Cecil 7 days a week, 18 hours a day from May through September, when cooling water temperature ends the shedding. By 4:30, Laird is threading Scotty Boy, his wooden 26-foot open crab skiff, through narrow marsh channels as a high half-moon begins its fade into the pre-dawn glow. Scotty Boy's 72 this summer, says Laird, who is 71. He's been aboard of her since he was 7, curling up in her tiny forepeak reading while his dad, Willard, crabbed. If a young man were to go crabbing, he wouldn't want her, Laird says. Too slow, too old, too little, too beat up and dirty. But here's the thing. If you can't catch crabs in her, you don't know how to crab, because she is a perfect boat for the job. You put me in a new boat, and I wouldn't even know how to crab. In fact, Laird is about as good as they get at catching soft crabs. It's not getting easier in these days of pollution, tightening regulations, and competition from foreign crab meat. His relatives have all left the water for truck driving, prison guarding, and captaining ferries. Scraping appears simple. You find a shallow seagrass bed and pull your twin scrapes slowly across the bottom, emptying them when their mesh bags fill with grass, plucking out the crabs that have sought refuge there to shed. Scrapes are made of iron and resemble the dredges of oystermen, except they have a smooth bar instead of teeth so they don't uproot the seagrass. I used to scrape beside Laird for 3 years when I took school kids from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation's Residential Education Center on Smith. I'd match precisely what he did and catch maybe one soft crab to his 10. It's an art to it, Laird allows. I've spent a lifetime studying a muddy streak, he says, referencing the light chocolate burls of sediment that trail from the scrapes. The way that mud looks tells you how the scrapes are working, if you are dragging too slow or too fast, if you need to take in rope or let it out, if you are scraping at the proper angle to the grass bed, if you are minding the rising and the falling of the tide, Laird says. It's mid-afternoon when he unloads his catch into his shedding tanks and fishes up again. He kicked me off Scotty Boy hours earlier, explaining it was time to get his game face on. On land, he said, I'm Dr. Jekyll, but out here crabbing, I've got to be Mr. Hyde. Now he's kicked back, cold beer in hand, in a rocking chair in the cool of the shanty with Roy Acuff blaring country across the marshes from a shockingly fine Harman Kardon and Bose audio setup. Maybe even more than Acuff, he likes Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, even Mahler sometimes. Well, I even love to play opera. I don't know one from the other or even understand the words, but I've loved to hear it ever since I was a kid. Posters on his shanty walls endorse Greenpeace, also Saving the Polar Bear, the Spotted Owl, and Tigers, and banning handguns. I've done a lot of reading, he says, and I can't bear what's happening to animals all over the world. They aren't free to roam anymore. I can't even stand cutting the faces out of soft crabs to clean them. Cecil does all that. Fewer and fewer watermen will undertake the labor and patience involved in scraping, Laird says. Most have gone to using a smaller mesh version of the hard crab pot to get their peelers. It concerns him because my way of working limits the crabs a man can take, but peeler potting, there's no limit to how many a man can fish. Soon he'll take a nap, followed by dinner, and fishing up yet again. Tomorrow, I'll do it all over again, Laird says. I hope never to change.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.